minutes here at the end of the day is Dr. Thomas Mason. Dr. Mason has been committed to making a contribution to help eliminate the health inequities that face the African American population, as well as improving the care of the patients that he serves. He is an internal medicine attending physician that has been active within his community, making numerous presentations throughout the country and locally on topics pertaining to Black men's health. He is an ambassador of the American Cancer Society and has been actively involved in teaching as well as mentoring medical students from Rush Medical College, the University of Illinois College of Medicine, and Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Mason is currently a clinical instructor of medicine at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. He is the medical director of the Near North Health Service Corporation, which is a group of 6 comprehensive federally qualified community health centers in the Chicago area. He is also a leadership member of Project Brotherhood, a Black men's clinic which is designed to provide holistic primary care and social services to Black men in Chicago. Dr. Mason is also a student at the University of Illinois, pursuing his master's degree in public health. Please welcome Dr. Thomas Mason.
Okay. Good afternoon. So I'm going to be talking today, the title of my presentation is Follow the Leader, How Does Hip-Hop Influence the Sexual Behavior of Urban Black Men? So I won't spend too much time on the data. I know through the sessions we've talked a lot about the data today and yesterday, but I did want to note, as we discussed, African-American women are actually account for the largest share of new HIV and AIDS cases in the United States. And again, mentioning that the primary mode of transmission is through heterosexual contact. Also wanted to mention that African-American men AIDS is the third leading cause of death and is the number one cause of death for African American women aged 25 to 34. Where's the burden? So as we know, there are approximately 1.1 million cases of HIV/AIDS currently in the United States. Approximately half of those are African Americans, and as we all know, African Americans only comprise 12% of the United States population. but nearly half of the cases of AIDS. So what do the numbers look like in Chicago? I put up this slide. This is actually the AIDS prevalence rates by community area in Chicago. And as I know it's difficult to see, Chicago has approximately 3 million residents. For those of you who have been to Chicago, this is the Loop area right here. This is downtown Chicago, where Grant Park, Navy Pier. So the highest prevalence of AIDS are here in the dark blue areas, primarily on the north side of Chicago. This right here is the Washington Park area on the south side of Chicago. And right here is the Woodlawn community where Project Brotherhood is located. We'll talk a little bit more about Project Brotherhood, but our clinic is located here, adjacent here in Washington Park is where Provident Hospital is. Cook County is a little bit higher. And we can discuss in the end maybe some of the reasons for the distribution in the AIDS cases in Chicago. There's a crisis. So this is just local Chicago data. The life expectancy for Black men is 60 compared to our white counterparts at 80 for white females. So what's being done about this? So back in 1998, Dr. Eric Whitaker, Dr. Linda Murray, the trauma department from Cook County got together and talked about what can we do about Black men's health in Chicago. So they put together 11 focus groups and surveyed the men, all different types of men, and asked them what are things keeping you from health care and what are things that we can do to bring you into the health care system. So Project Brotherhood was created. Primarily to create a safe, respectable place where Black men can come in, access health care. We abandoned the traditional medical model and embraced the WHO definition of health, that health is a complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being, not merely the absence of disease and infirmity. We've really focused on the social component, and we know that and Craig Spivey is our director of social services, and he'll be presenting tomorrow on the use of the social cognitive theory within Project Brotherhood and how focusing on the social issues of men are really the primary factors that prevent men from accessing healthcare and being concerned about their health. We use a multidisciplinary approach where physicians aren't the only ones providing care. We know that we need a team of not just physicians, but we have master-level social workers, health educators, lay health workers, our students, all working together and providing care. One of the things that came out of the focus groups was the participants said that they wanted providers that could relate to them, that understood what they were going through, and so we've tried to staff our clinic with primarily African-American male physicians, social workers, staff. Another important thing to mention is that we're part of the Cook County Health and Hospital System. We're affiliated with Cook County, so we're able to provide care regardless of a patient's ability to pay. This is actually a picture from one of our social support groups. So every Thursday night, Project Brotherhood is from 4 to 7, and we have, at the same time, we have a social support discussion going on. We have in the back of the clinic, we have medical sessions being provided, and on the side of the social support group, we have a barber that cuts hair for free. So over the years, one of the biggest draws have been the guys know they can come and get free food and free haircuts. So, and as you see, so during the social support group, guys are getting called out to get their hair cut, and they're not too far away from the discussion any given Thursday. And so this is actually one of our master level social workers, Steve Daly. And the discussion varies, and sometimes it'll be what's going on in the news to Dr. Thomas or myself may give a talk on a medical issue. But our social support, we have individual counseling, resume writing, mock interviews. The barbershop, traditionally our barber has been a health educator, so and trained on HIV Red Cross prevention, and discusses with the guys while he's cutting their hair what's going on in their lives and kind of directing them to either a medical visit or the social worker or wherever to get the care he needs. We have real-time appointments, walk-in appointments. We use a holistic approach to healthcare. So, and I wanted to transition into the discussion as far as of hip-hop and how hip-hop affects the sexual behavior of black men. And hip-hop has become one of the most popular types of music in the world. It's become one of the most influential cultures in the world. I just wanted to make the distinction as well that hip-hop is a culture as well. It's not, the terms can be used interchangeably as hip-hop is music, but it's also a culture that a lot of people follow. I wanted to explore some of the relationships that men had in relation to what they listened to in their sexual behavior. So we did two focus groups. I'll be presenting the preliminary data from the first focus group. This is actually a picture. This isn't a picture of the focus group. This is where the focus group was held. These are actually some of our students. We have a strong mentoring component as well with Project Brotherhood. And there were 14 participants in this focus group. About half of the focus group participants were high school students, and the rest of the participants were Project Brotherhood, people who were participating in Project Brotherhood that day. All African-American men, all from the south side of Chicago. I also collected demographic information from all of the participants. The majority lived with family. Probably most of those were the high school students. Three were homeless. Two lived in a shelter, and one lived with a partner. The majority were unemployed. Three were employed, three were students who weren't working. So I started the focus group by asking just the current state of hip-hop and what people felt about hip-hop. And the first, one of the first quotes I wanted to read was one of the students said, "Rap today are stories about the lifestyles that rappers feel like they've been forced to live. The stuff they rap about is the stuff that I see every day. They're doing it for the money. The good rappers aren't on the air. The artists rapping about positive messages can't earn enough money to make it." So we transitioned from here into, and we also used a semi-structured interview guide, and the next portion of the focus group was asking specifically, do the men feel that hip-hop influences the sexual behavior of black men? And one person said, it makes a promiscuous lifestyle appealing. You go to sleep with it and wake up with it the next day. It affects how you think. Another man said, the video suggests the image that if you look cool, have the cars and multiple women on your side, you're untouchable. The young ladies also think it's cool. An older gentleman said, hip-hop encourages extramarital sex. For the most part, it doesn't encourage marriage or discretion. Physical attraction and instinct are all that's necessary for sex, according to the music. Another man said, you can't blame the rappers. The rappers aren't the ones who are putting out the music. It's not the rapper's fault. Who's putting out the music? All the music we're hearing on the radio is music someone is putting out to us. They are giving it to us. We aren't going out and looking for it. Another man said, everything influences you. Rap music is going to influence you. Your household is going to influence you. Your friends are going to influence you. The movies are going to influence you. Scarface influences you. So he went into talking about Scarface and how it made an impact on him. One of the students said, now there's less discretion. And he was talking to one of the older guys in the focus group. We see things now on the TV that you all never thought you'd see on TV. Older cats remember when it was just the radio. We see stuff rated R on TV that comes on at 10 o'clock. Now, this is interesting. When I transitioned to, has hip-hop affected your sexual behavior, the first person came out initially said, rap music has affected me by causing me to commit adultery, fornication, and immoral sexual behaviors. And so after that, it was quiet. And no one wanted to say anything for a while. And so I kind of tried to facilitate and make sure that I let everyone know everything was confidential, that this wouldn't leave the room. And one of the older gentlemen said, with R&B back in the day, the Isley Brothers would set it off. You didn't have to do the talking. They would talk for you. Okay. Now, this is interesting. So one of the students said, I think we live in a microwave generation where everything is fast and on the go. I heard some older cats mentioning the Isley Brothers, how they set it up for you, and you didn't have to say nothing. In today's music, R. Kelly may be our Isley Brothers. He's not saying, come on, girl, strip, take your time, like the Isleys. It's more like, get in the door, take it off, we don't need no foreplay, put you on the kitchen counter, it's no talking. No, how you doing? How was your day? It's bend over. Let me smack that. Come on, you know what I want. And following that, another student said, when you see someone in the limelight doing something or saying something, it has the effect of making you want to do the same things they say and do to take their status and put our status on the upper level. So in addition to the focus groups, we did a pilot survey with 117 black men. The survey was developed by the Project Brotherhood leadership. Approximately one-third of the respondents were from Project Brotherhood. A third were from the Urban Prep Academy Charter High School on the south side of Chicago. And another third were approximately from Church Men's Forum, where Dr. Thomas and I gave a presentation to approximately 100 men. So the demographic information, the age range was from 14 to 74. By far, the majority of the men were single. The majority of the men had some college. Most had not had any gang involvement or been incarcerated, and about half were fathers. So the first question was, do you think hip-hop music influences the sexual behavior of black men? And we used a Likert scale with strongly agree, agree, disagree, strongly disagree. So by far, 77% of the men either strongly agreed or agreed that it did influence the sexual behavior of black men. The next question I also stratified the results based on age, and it looks as though the all age ranges, they all felt the same. The next question: do you think hip-hop music has influenced your sexual behavior? And by far, the vast majority said no. Only 29% either agreed or strongly agreed that it affected their sexual behavior. And there are several theories I have and things that we thought about why this overwhelming response did not think it affected their sexual behavior, but said that it affected everyone else's. And that was true throughout the age ranges as well. We also asked, do you think that hip-hop promotes unprotected sex? And the vast majority, 67%, said that they did either strongly agreed or agreed that it affected, promoted unprotected sex. And that also was seen amongst the age groups. We asked if they thought that musicians should play an active role in promoting safe sex, and by far all the respondents agreed that the musicians should take a stronger role, and that was also agreed throughout the age ranges. Another question we asked, do you think that hip-hop promotes gay or lesbian behavior? And the reason we added this question, this came out of the focus groups, one of the students said that he strongly felt that hip-hop influenced lesbianism and started quoting lyrics from several songs as far as women kissing women, dancing with women. Another student was quoting pop song, culture songs that were promoting the same sort of behavior. And by far, the men did not think that it promoted gay or lesbian behavior. We also wanted to stratify the results based on how often people listen to hip-hop, and by far the majority listen to hip-hop every day. We broke it down as far as every day, occasionally, only when it's on the radio or television, and never. So very few never listen to it. It's hard not to hear hip-hop nowadays. So I wanted to talk about the survey limitations. It was a small sample size. It was a convenient sample as well. I think one thing that came out is when I distributed the survey after the focus group, I got many more people did say that they felt that hip-hop influenced their own sexual behavior as well as it influences the behavior of all black men. But when we were giving the survey out in different places, people were much more reluctant and seemed to answer that it affected themselves, affected them. I think part of it is also that it's easier for us to criticize other people as opposed to making critical judgments about ourselves. And also with a subset of the people, I'm sure there is some sort of disconnect or denial or maybe not even understanding in some ways that there may be some relationship to listening to the music and your own sexual behaviors. It was interesting how, like I said, vast majority felt like it influenced others, but not themselves. And it was noted that there are many influences on the sexual behavior of black men. But by far, the respondents in both focus groups felt that hip hop was the strongest. I wanted to talk a little bit about the solutions and where do we go from here. I think we need to do more focus groups and ask more black men. And with Project Brotherhood, we start by always asking our men what they feel. And we've created culturally and gender-specific interventions based on those results, our data from the surveys and focus groups. This is a very personal topic to me as well. I've don't mind saying I've listened to hip-hop since the early 80s when I was in junior high school, and I'm kind of dating myself, but I've seen the progression of hip-hop and hip-hop music, and one thing I think is interesting that many people may not know is that the explicit lyrics, the objectification of women, the disrespect towards women isn't new in hip-hop. it has been since the very beginning. There has been no change whatsoever. And I can tell you, artists from the 80s, Kool G Rap, DJ Polo, Talk Like Sex, Luke, I know a lot of you have heard of Luke, Too Short. But the difference now versus then is that was what was considered underground hip-hop. It was underground, but you couldn't find it. You had to search for it. They weren't playing any sort of hip-hop on the radio. Radio stations were opposed to hip-hop, you know, in the early 90s. Late 80s, and now I think an issue is the fact that it's played all the time, every day. You can't get away from it, and there's no, I think, you know, a next step it would be to focus more on media regulation or restrictions on the explicit music and what time it's played. And I'd like to give the parallel of with the movie industry. There isn't a big uproar about trying to eliminate adult videos. It's just, it's difficult for people. There's restrictions on when certain things can be shown on television, what time, what stations, so forth. I think the same thing should be applied for hip-hop. And, you know, once we get into the discussion, I'd like to hear if anyone, you know, has any other ideas. But it shouldn't be played during, certain music shouldn't be played at certain times, and there should be some sort of grading system on the music and when it's played. But I think that it's going to take a multi-level approach. I think it's, again, it should start with the people who are in the communities, and we need to survey the men and ask them what they think as well, and not just come up with policies and guidelines based on what we think. And I also just wanted to say that Project Brotherhood, we've had a history of working with rap artists to promote more positive messages on the south side of Chicago, and focusing on what are some of the things that we can do with the youth, with our mentoring component, to help kind of curb some of these ideas and thoughts. So thank you.
Thank you to all of our wonderful presenters this afternoon. We are fortunate that we do have several moments for questions. I ask that as you ask your questions, please stand and state, state your question loudly so that we can save time by not having to restate your question once again. And I think this young lady's first, if you could stand and state your question.
Hello. I have a question related to the suggestion that you made about possibly rating hip-hop and times of play. I have two sons who are like pre-adolescent, and the hip-hop that's played on radio, it seems as though they attempt to censor it because they have like the clean versions and then they have the underground explicit versions that they don't play on radio, but my kids know what all the stuff that they bleep out is. So in terms of like rating and how parental advisory notices are currently on a lot of the hip-hop, what have you heard or found about the possibility of there being a regulation system that's not viewed as censorship?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think that, like you said, even with the censored version, that's a joke to think that the kids can't figure out what's actually being said. And they can easily go on the internet and find out exactly what's being said. So I haven't really looked into the next step as far as changing the policy, and I think that's something that we will move forward to do and look at what do we need to do to make these changes. Even if it is an uncensored version, I think that shouldn't be a barrier to giving it a proper rating. So that's how I feel about it.
Thank you, Dr. Mason. And next question here.
I had a question to him. You spoke about the knowledge behavior gap. Mm-hmm. Now, why do you think that exists, and what can be done to address that?
The question was about the knowledge behavior gap. I'm not sure, but what I can tell you, what I think sometimes, and what's interesting about listening to the presentation that you just gave, and I've noticed that even, and I'm working with Lisa Boleg, who's over there in Philly right now, and I've been doing work with men who have sex with men, bisexual men, and heterosexual men. And I can tell you this is something that strings along regardless of someone's sexual orientation. Like, there's a very high level of eloquence when we talked about what are the problems among black men, whether it be heterosexual men, bisexual men, homosexual men. But then when you look at your individual behaviors and you talk, you seem to think that there is some kind of disconnect. So with the bisexual men, they knew a lot of stuff, but they made a conscious decision. I think a lot of people do that, and a couple of the quotes that I presented were actually talking about how someone thought it through. You know, we both get tested. If it's a dude, he's not going to get pregnant. If I trust this person, people think about those things. They may not write them all out, but there's a subconscious thing going on. And then also, I think there's a tendency, one, with the social desirability bias, with responding in some of these surveys or focus groups or interviews. And then on top of that, we also tend to think there's a negative. We can't ignore the pejorative connotation to unprotected sex. No one looks at natural sex as safe sex. There's all these terms about, you know, safe, unsafe, unprotected. And so no one really celebrates sex as a natural, holistic thing, whether it be between men or women or between men and men or women and women. And so I think there's a reluctancy to claim your own stuff in that because it's seen as such a negative. So you can say, well, brothers are engaging in unprotected sex because they listen to hip-hop too much. With the MSM that we've interviewed, they say, well, it's low self-esteem, and they don't feel good about themselves, and they're doing drugs. And then when you say, well, why do you think you had unprotected sex? It was like, well, it was just the heat of the moment. Well, it felt better. And it's like, well, you're so nuanced in talking about why everybody else, you know, has low self-esteem or these mediators or steps going to this. So I don't know whether there's just kind of a disconnect where we don't want to because there's such a negative connotation put on it right now. Even if you think it through and are responsible with it, if you're not having sex without a condom, people really look at you in a negative way. But a lot of people still are having unprotected sex. So I think that may be part of the culture that we're living in right now.
Thank you, Dr. Malbrecht. Back at the very back, sitting down, the gentleman.
My question is for David. In your conclusions, you put forth that in a paradigm shift that we should move from the whole sexual orientation measurement to actually measuring behaviors. So with the stuff, work you've been doing over the years, have you, what kind of concordance or lack thereof have you seen between someone presenting my sexual orientation as this versus this is the kind of sexual behavior I'm engaged in?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of discordance, and particularly there's a lot of work and studies, not only my own, but just general studies that we've seen with discordance being higher among black or men of African descent about what you claim your sexual identity is and then what the behaviors are you actually do. But black men don't have a monopoly on secretive bisexuality or discordance between sexual identification and behavior. When you look at a lot of the studies, the Latino men are doing the same thing, the Asian men are doing the same thing, and God knows politicians and white men. And I'm not going to name names. I could list about five or six of them. Tap their shoes under, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, the thing is that there's always going to be a discordance about this. And I think as a medical provider and a public health practitioner, I think it behooves us to kind of stay away. I think sexual orientation is important. I think disclosure is important. But when we're looking at public health, this is a behavioral-driven disease. And if we get sidetracked on the behavior or on the identification and the disclosure part, we miss out on the behavior part. And I'm interested in what did you do? I don't care what you call yourself in this situation or in this situation, or how with this girl you told her you were bisexual, but if the brother you told him you were homosexual. I don't care about all that. What I want to know is, did you strap on with anal sex, vaginal sex, oral sex? What did you do? And so I think we kind of have to move away from that. But I think looking at the history of HIV, the HIV epidemic, it very much ran parallel with a gay civil rights epidemic and homosexual men becoming comfortable in disclosing who they are and being proud of being homosexual. So I think it's right now we're seeing a position where because the demographics is shifting, we have to kind of pull those two apart a little bit because they're completely different cultural considerations that we have to account for.
Thank you, and I'd like to thank the audience for keeping your questions relatively short, but we are going to try to take a few more questions. The young lady here on the end.
I have a question.
Could you stand?
Hi, sorry, I have a question. I think my question goes to kind of like your conclusions as far as, you know, rap and hip-hop have been around for a long time. I'm relatively young, so I can remember people like MC Light and, you know, Salt and Pepper. I think the difference now is the saturation of rap music and what you said, the culture, if you look at MTV, if you look at BET, when we were younger, it was like you had one show, Yo MTV Raps, and now you have like tip drill, you have like this whole saturation of all these images, and I think that that may be something that we should look into, is maybe not that rap music has gotten any worse, but it is everywhere. It is in the culture. The kind of pornographic aspects of it are everywhere. It's more prevalent. It's like the prevalence of images and maybe not necessarily rap in general. And I wanted to hear your kind of comments on that. Did you ask the students or your focus group or an interview how much rap music they listen to? What images were they saturated? I mean, specifically young people.
We did ask them how much. It was just limited to the survey, though. Everyone who was in the focus group did the survey. And this is a pilot survey. We're going to refine it and ask more detailed questions so we can see, based on how many hours per day or per week that someone's listening to hip-hop, what type of behaviors and how do they feel about sexual behaviors. But I agree. I think that we have to demand, at this point, more restrictions or regulations in terms of media sources, radio, television, and implementing some sort of new structure that will prohibit certain images, like tip drill. That video should not be played in, I won't say period, but it should be either, you have to pay for it or something. But certain images and videos, I think, we should now think about placing the same sort of emphasis that was placed on adult movies on hip-hop and some rap videos, and say the exact same thing with the radio industry, putting more of some sort of regulation on what time even censored things, songs could be played, and seeing what needs to be done, what type of policy steps need to happen for that to take place.
And I did signal a gentleman in the back with one last question.
My question is for David. Regarding disclosure from male, bisexually active black men to black females, it's interesting that disclosure may not be important in terms of HIV transmission itself in an epidemiological sense, but you just said in your last comment that disclosure may be important, and I'm presuming in terms of the quality of relationships that black men and black women can have together. Did any of your participants specifically mention the role of black women, perhaps outing them as bisexually active or gay black men in terms of their lack of disclosure to their black female partners?
That's a great question. There was a sense from some of our participants that they were worried, and I think they were more concerned that from the women in their lives, whether it was a primary partner or just black women in general, that there would be a compromise.